Welcome to Aware. We are dedicated to communicating information that inspires your positive growth and change. Are you interested in a peaceful planet? Are you interested in optimal health? Are you living with purpose? Are you enjoying your life? We realize each person can make a difference, and our mission is to empower your awareness. The choices that you make in every moment shape your life, and we encourage you to realize that you have your own answers and to always listen to your own truth. We invite you to stay aware. Welcome to the Aware Show. I am Lisa Garr. A couple things I want to let you know first of all is you can always go to my website, which is theawareshow.com, and check out all the places that we broadcast every week. And we have a lot of our shows up there. And also, I have a television show on Gaia TV, and you can check that out at inspirationsongaia.com. And check out a lot of the people that I interview on the radio are also on video. So a lot of great opportunity to check that out, too, and go through some exercises with people. All of this is transformational video and transformational media, which is what we are up to and have been for 18 years now with the Aware Show. And that's a lot of things we're talking about today. We're going to be answering some of these questions. Maybe. How do we get here? What is the purpose of life? Where do we go when we die? Have you ever asked these questions? How did you get here? Where did you come from? Where do you go from here? What purpose is it that you're here for? These are the questions that my guest today, Steve Hassenberg, has asked himself. At 8 years old, Steve Hassenberg became a therapist, but to his dysfunctional mother. And at 12 years old, he had an out-of-body experience that changed his life at 12. So he found himself asking these questions and then later found himself at the side of Maharishi, writing meditation programs for prisoners, and now is a spiritual psychologist, psychotherapist actually, in Santa Monica, talking about how to live with these questions and the duality that we live in. Welcome, Steve. Thanks for joining me.
Well, sounds like a wonderful show, Lisa.
Sounds like a great guy, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does.
Good thing that you get to laugh at yourself.
That's a good intro. I love it.
Oh, you can take it.
Thank you.
So I am curious about this experience at 12 years old that you remembered.
Oh, you know, that experience was an inception point for the rest of my life in a certain way. I didn't know it till later, but I was at a Y camp in New Jersey. My parents forced me to go. Mm-hmm. And I was standing up at bat. I was going to be, you know, hitting a ball. And all of a sudden, I was watching the game from a tree in the right field. And I was shocked. But when boys are shocked, they don't want to say anything about it. They're just shocked.
They're just still.
And life keeps going on. And so I watched myself standing there. And then all of a sudden, I shot back into my body, and I thought, wow, what just happened? And then I shot back into the other field, and I was watching myself at bat. And there was no fear. I felt like I was in a timeless space. And then I came back in my body, and I hit the ball. But that was such an important moment because in some way, and this is for a 12-year-old that didn't understand what was going on, but in some way, I knew that I was more than my body. I was a spirit. There was something about me that was a spirit, and that spirit from time to time was somewhere else, and most of the time was in my body. So that's how it began.
So you traveled to basically other dimensions, if you were to think about it.
I did.
But as a child, did you think it was an overactive imagination, or was there something really special about that moment?
No, you know, I didn't want to tell anybody because I thought they'd say I
right.
was mad.
Yeah.
So I just lived with it. But I never forgot it. It was so powerful. Mm. And then when I was 22 years old, I had started Transcendental Meditation with Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, which I'm sure your listeners know who that is. Mm-hmm. And I was sitting in Mallorca, Spain, on a meditation course, and in the blink of an eye, I was rising from my body into the ceiling, and then I shot out through the roof of the hotel. And I was going through outer space, just like you see on the Hubble. Hmm. And I saw stars and I saw planets. And I thought to myself, you should be absolutely terrified. And I was at peace. And I had a feeling of eternal peace and timelessness. And I got to a barrier. It's the same barrier they talk about in the near-death experiences. And passing that barrier, I would have left my body. And I had the sense to turn around,
mm-hmm.
and I actually watched the Earth come into view. You know, like those gorgeous shots of the Earth, this gorgeous lit-up orb in the middle of black space. And I would have cried, but I had no body, so I couldn't cry. But I would have cried out of absolute happiness, absolute joy, and the preciousness of what I saw. And then I came back, I saw the Spain coming up on my radar, and I wound up in my body, and my body was vibrating, and I opened my eyes, and I never felt better in my entire life.
Hmm. And this experience, did it match the experience at 12 years old?
It was much grander, obviously. I mean, it was gorgeous and colorful, and that was the experience at 22. That kind of fleshed out the experience at 12.
At 12, I see.
Because at 12, at 22, I knew for certain that I was an eternal being. And that began my quest to understand life.
Well, you knew for certain that you were a part of a greater picture and that this wasn't the only dimension that we live in.
I knew I was a multidimensional being in mm-hmm. some way. But it took me many years to actually begin to live that. I had a lot of spiritual experiences in my life. But in order to actually ground that into a human experience takes
right.
a long time.
So how do you teach people to live with this duality of knowing that we are maybe coexisting somewhere else, or could, yet we have the struggles of everyday life and the density?
We have both, Lisa. Each of us knows that at the bottom of everything, we have extraordinary challenges as human beings. And then at times we have these experiences of utter freedom, utter joy. Could be watching a sunset, could be watching a child being born, could even be watching somebody die at times.
Mm.
And it's not joy, but it's a connection into a deeper reality.
Hmm.
And you asked how I integrated that. Well, you know, I know you and I are both on that path of integration. And in my work that I do in Santa Monica, I'm always teaching people to meditate no matter what issues they come in to deal with. Because without teaching individuals how to go to the source,
mm-hmm.
to their own soul, to the peace of their own soul. That's why the Buddhists call it the refuge. The Buddhists call the meditation practice the refuge because it's a shelter against the storm. And in so many ways, life is a storm. It's not always a storm, but there are big weather systems that we have to go through. And I actually spend a lot of time talking to my clients in my workshops about the fact that the storm is actually a calling from the soul, that the adversities that we go through are ways of challenging us to be deeper, bigger human beings. And they ask us to find capacities that we never knew that we had.
Well, I do understand that, and I love the idea of making psychotherapy practice where you teach people to meditate because then they have the tool to deal with it in their own. I know a particular friend of mine who's going through, his mother died several years ago, and he didn't really ever process it, or he tried, but it was so shocking for him. And now, several years later, he's going through kind of, it looks like a midlife crisis, but where he's really lost and his soul is aching and hurting. And so if he has a therapist he goes and talks with every single week, but he's still in the same place.
Correct.
Yeah. That's a big difference.
It's a huge difference mm-hmm. because all of us, the Earth experience is an experience where we are cast into a material existence, and we forget where we've come from. We forget the innate power that we have inside of us. And by forgetting the power we have, which is also peace, compassion, love, kindness, these are all aspects of the soul. When we don't have any education about reaching back to what is fundamental and central to our existence, then we're like leaves in the wind. And so the issue of going to therapy and just talking about a problem could help, but it's never going to solve the problem on a fundamental level. That has to be solved by teaching people in many different ways to reconnect with their soul, whether it's a mindful practice, whether it's a meditation practice, even doing yoga helps people relax. So there's so many ways of helping people to get to the source of themselves. And by getting to that source, the problems that we have in life, I can't say are eradicated, but they're certainly lessened, because we have a sense that there's peace inside of me, apart from what I'm going through in my life.
And you had a specific event happen in your life recently where you had an illness or a bout with chronic fatigue syndrome. And this is the middle of your practice. This is recently, right?
Very recently, Lisa.
And what did it tell you about yourself after you've been through meditation for years and teaching other people how to meditate and deal with controversy? How did you deal with this experience?
It's a good question. I like your questions, Lisa.
Good. That's great.
No, they're really good. They're really good. They're very, very to the heart of everything. So let me just background this a tad bit because it will make more sense. So I had a very long-term prominent psychotherapy practice. I call it spiritual psychotherapy in Santa Monica. I wound up getting Epstein-Barr virus. I can tell you about why I think I got it, too, after I described this.
Were you overworking? Yeah, we should talk about that.
You want to hear that part, too?
Yeah, mm-hmm, of course.
Okay. So my daughter got Lyme's disease and became suicidal after a while.
Ooh.
My daughter was only 20 years old.
Mm.
And I spent about 2 years kind of talking her down almost every night for 2 years. By the way, she's okay now.
Oh, that's good. She lived with you.
She lived with my wife, my ex-wife, but I talked to her every night or I saw her every day.
Mm-hmm.
So that was going on. On top of that, my mother was getting dementia. So I had so much going on in my life, and my tendency, which is a long-term tendency, is to do too much.
Yeah.
To want to help too much.
Yeah.
Be of service.
Yeah.
Without taking care of myself.
I understand that. Mm-hmm.
And so what happened to me was I did too much, and I wound up with Epstein-Barr virus.
Hmm.
But it was very virulent, which meant I had brain inflammation. So I lost my ability to talk clearly. I would slur my words. I lost my ability to be intuitive, to think into the future.
Mm-hmm.
I was walking on Wilshire Boulevard one day, and I stopped, and I forgot how to lift my legs.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, I didn't panic, but it scared me a lot. And then I had to say, okay, well, how do you do this? Something that's automatic and natural to us, that was being lost as well.
Was it a split second, or did you get back your pacing after that?
Well, I stopped in the middle of the sidewalk, and it took me about 3 minutes to kind of get going again.
Mm, okay,
that happened many, many times.
Oh.
So in essence, I lost my practice. for 3 years, and we lost our home, our dream home.
Wow.
I couldn't make an income. I couldn't talk well.
Oh.
I was a mere shadow of myself.
Oh, wow. That's significant. That is significant. So you really couldn't rebound with all the tools you had, with everything that you knew. Did you feel like you were in a box where you couldn't help yourself?
Well, I felt like whatever was going on with me, and I went to a lot of doctors, and my internist told me it was in my mind. And it wasn't until a friend of mine who's a naturopathic doctor was coming out from Idaho where he has a clinic. We had lunch together. He said, man, you are really sick. I'm going to take you back to Idaho with me. And I went back the next week, and he put me on what he was using, which is a protocol for cancer from Europe. High-potency vitamins, minerals, vitamin C, 75,000 units, for 4 to 5 hours a day for 3 weeks. And I was, Lisa, I was about 40% better after the 3 weeks of the vitamin
infusion. Wow, 4 to 5 hours a day.
Yep.
That will do it.
Huh. It was intense. The humility, I can't tell you how humble it makes you. To sit in a room with other people getting these infusions who have cancer, terminal illness, and you just feel like you're at the end of the world somewhere.
And then you, after you started to feel that it was helping, did other people around you also have those experiences?
Yeah, a lot of people, many people have been to Germany. And in Germany, I'd say they have the cutting edge natural tools for dealing with illness. And they were bringing those tools back with them, and my friend Michael was helping them. And they were on the similar kind of protocol that I was. And we would all talk in these rooms for hours a day about our predicament.
Well, I mean, to know that something like this works for something like chronic fatigue and Epstein-Barr, that is groundbreaking. 75,000 milligrams of vitamin C in an aggressive vitamin protocol, 4 to 5 hours a day.
Right.
Wow. You'll have to tell us about that.
I brought that protocol back with me and started working with my doctor back here, Dr. Gisler, in Santa Monica. And after about 9 months, I woke up and I was free.
Wow.
I was done. But it took me about another year to get my strength back.
But it eradicated the disease.
The disease was gone. The Epstein-Barr virus was gone.
It was gone.
So then I could start my life over. So the last couple of years has been rebirthing a life that I never thought I'd have to rebirth.
Wow. That is phenomenal. I mean, it truly, you've been through this firsthand several times now, and you are back on the path. So what did you learn from that experience?
Well, you know, while I was going through it, I didn't like it. I can't tell anybody. Because I was a lifelong meditator, because I had practiced yoga since I was 20 years old, that I got through this thing easily. So I didn't.
Right. Well, and then what about that, oh, and everything happens for a reason. Do you believe that that did?
I believe everything happens for a reason, yes. I believe that there are no accidents. I believe that what happened to me, which is called in literature the dark night of the soul, was truly a dark night. And the dark night takes us deep inside of ourselves, our unconscious, and it gives us a choice. I didn't understand the choice I was making till later, but I understand it now. And the choice was that the meditation was, I couldn't even meditate. I'd been meditating since I was 20 years old. I could not quiet my mind down. But at the same time, what I learned from all that meditation was to be present. And so what I did do well during that period was that I was very present to myself and the disease. And in that presence, I was also very loving. I was very compassionate
with yourself,
to myself, and that compassion grew. And I realized in retrospect that what I was learning from that experience was that being compassionate to myself at a deeper level than I could ever, ever imagine, being compassionate to myself was what I was asked to learn by my soul during that period. I had been compassionate to everyone my whole life. Mm-hmm. In fact, we started this conversation, I told you, I was a giver, and I didn't have limits in my giving.
Well, when it comes to kids, though, when it comes to your own children, even as adults, it's you give of yourself. You give of your energy. Do you think
right.
a little of that was going on, or a lot of that?
Well, you know, yes, as a parent, we do that, and it's natural. I'm talking about giving to friends, giving to clients too much. Mm. So it was a lifetime of too much giving, and what I realized during the experience was I was giving to be okay. I was giving to be loved. I was giving to be noble.
Accepted.
I was giving to be respected
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
instead of honoring myself more. And so the self-compassion and the self-love and the, finally the giving to myself was the beginning of a journey after I got better, after my strength came back, a spiritual journey that has continued since that time.
You know, you hear of people going through this and then their spouse leaves them at the same time because they can't handle it. How did that work for you with your relationship?
Another good question. It was very painful
mm-hmm.
because Cynthia, my wife, who I love dearly, we love each other dearly, we call each other twin flames,
mm-hmm.
She came from a background where her family was not there for her in various ways. And so there was an expectation that I would always be there for her. And so this was a crushing blow. It was a very difficult time for us, where I had left, where I was no longer earning money, where I was no longer the protector, where I was no longer the man in the house. And
the provider. Mm-hmm.
The provider, even though we both provide, you know, mm-hmm. in equal ways. But what happened, you know, for her was very interesting, because had I not gotten so ill, she probably wouldn't have stepped up in her own life.
Mm.
And created an intuitive energy healer, but she pushed all the edges of that, wound up on radio shows, wound up doing workshops, retreats online. So her force, her masculine force, came into the fore, because in some way it was necessitated. They say necessity is the mother of invention. And in some way she reinvented herself in a masculine way. I reinvented myself in a more feminine way of going inside to take care of myself, and she was going outside to take care of us.
Yes. And in a way, if you look back on it, an incredible life lesson to balance that out and to allow her to get her strength and teach and share with people and help change people's lives.
Correct.
Now, how long ago did this happen?
I'm out of this. It's been about 2.5 years.
And you don't feel the Epstein-Barr or the chronic fatigue anymore?
No.
But,
you know, it's gone. And I would say I'm healthier than I've ever been. Because it wasn't supposed, you know, again, from a soulful point of view, my take on it, it wasn't supposed to debilitate me through time. As I learned the lesson of the illness didn't have to be there anymore. And so I've learned the lesson deeply.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we learn these lessons deeply, then what is, we could call the adversary? The adversary doesn't have to do its dirty work, because the dirty work is the dirty work of the soul, to get us to reclaim ourselves, to reclaim our power, to reclaim our love, to reclaim our beauty. And once you do that, the adversity doesn't need to be there.
Mm. Hmm. Well, in what you're looking at now in terms of thriving and living a healthy existence, what does your day look like with taking care of you? Like, what does that look like for those of us that don't know what that means?
How do I take care of me?
Yeah.
Well, a lot, you know, a lot has happened. Just from a practical point of view, my diet has changed dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm on the simplest of diets, light protein, fish, and vegetables and fruit. That's all I eat. I cheat sometimes with Girl Scout cookies, but...
Okay.
Okay, but that's my diet. I've been on that diet for a year. I do at least a half hour of yoga every morning. I'm exercising about 5 to 6 times a week. And I'm doing about 45 minutes of meditation morning and evening.
Wow, that's like 3 or 4 hours every day where you're dedicating to yourself.
Yep.
Okay. Now, that is in the healing process. But do you ever think, I don't have this kind of time? Do you ever feel pressured for time? Or do
No.
you just unwaveringly protect yourself?
No. I have a different relationship to time than I used to.
Let's talk about that. Okay. Yes.
Do you like that topic?
Oh, yeah.
This interview is probably as thorough as I've been in talking about what happened to me. So I'm learning something.
Good. Okay. Well,
a lot from this.
A lot of people are relating to this a lot because,
good.
First
good.
Of all, you've told us something very human that people have in terms of illness and disease, and they totally get frozen as to what to do about it. You
yeah.
found something that cured your Epstein-Barr. I mean, that's unheard of.
Right.
That's huge. And that this Dr. Gisler in Santa Monica currently uses this protocol, which is a huge piece of information.
She does. And they're probably the cutting edge of medicine in California, New York, Chicago, has to do with these high-potency vitamin and mineral infusions.
Yes. Okay. Then that's a huge piece of information. And
I'm glad to share that.
And now we're talking about time. I mean, this is a great conversation. Yes.
Time changed for me, Lisa.
What happened?
Dramatically. Well, what began to happen about 2 years ago was I started to have these very, very powerful spiritual experiences. And they would, all of them, if I can, what the commonality would be is, let's say, a dissolution of my ego. So my own, let's say, the control, time, so much of time has to do with our fear that we're not going to have enough time. And what not having enough time means for me and for other people, my clients, I'm not going to fulfill myself. I'm not going to be the success that I want to be. I won't find the love that I'm searching for. I'll never have the family that I dreamed of as a child. It goes on and on. And in so many subtle ways, and also gross ways, we push ourselves through time in order to fulfill ourselves. But what was happening to me with the dissolution of my ego was that I was arriving at a place it's more integrated, and I kind of live in this space. But I was arriving at a space where I was experiencing the fulfillment within myself in regards to everything that I desired. My desire at times for fame, my desire for notoriety, my desire for financial success, all of those things at their heart really have to do with self-fulfillment, happiness, joy. And I was experiencing this joy, happiness, fulfillment without a cause. There was no cause for it. I would wake up in the middle of the night, and I do now often, and I'm in a state of fulfillment. I'm in a state of joy. And you go, well, nothing occurred. No, because the essence of who we are is that experience. So that was being integrated into my life. And because of that, my rushing through time changed to something very interesting. I was beginning to savor my life instead of rushing past it. And in that savoring of my life, there was a preciousness that I was experiencing that I had never experienced in my life. A preciousness for the wind, the sun, the stars, the people in my life, the love. Everything was heightened, and it becomes like a very glorious kind of existence. And that's something that I'm moving in and out of all the time now. And I realized that was from the hardship, the pain, the facing of the pain, the facing of the fear that I had gone through had allowed me to open up a portal to myself that I had sought my entire life.
Now, do you still work at a certain pace? I mean, what do you think about an income and paying for a mortgage or that again?
How does that all work?
Yeah.
Well, I'm a very proactive person, so I've always done that, and I love my work, so I've never thought of my work as anything but, a place that was an opportunity to be creative and and use my imagination. So I have a regular life. I pay a mortgage, I have cars, we have health insurance, I go to work, I have a normal practice.
You don't live on a rock. You don't live on a rock. You're a practical life, right?
I don't live on an island off of berries.
Uh-huh.
So I have a normal life, but the addition to this life of finally knowing who I am has been the greatest addition that I could ever imagine.
It makes everything
life
else...
Life doesn't change. Mm. It only gets enhanced.
Mm. That is incredible. So it makes everything else, the bills or taxes or traffic or anything like that, go away, right?
It's a process. So, we could talk about the process. It's progressive. This is the way I'm putting it these days. There's a movement from the heaviness of material life into the lightness of being. And that lightness of being is what I just described, that which exists in all of us. Nobody is without it. We're born with that.
Kind of like how you feel when you go on vacation. Yeah.
There you go.
Don't
that's
laugh.
That's perfect, because you often feel, I do,
right,
that the moments that you're in are precious.
And you change your state. And everything
right.
relaxes, and you go to a different location that's very, it's fun, and you're time off, and you have time with family. And so that's that state, and then you lose it when you come back home because life happens again and all the stresses
life
of schedule.
Life takes over. The heaviness of life takes us over.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you
so
maintain
can you
that.
Imagine if the heaviness didn't exist anymore, or... It existed in a more diminished state.
Right, right. So taxes still happen and mortgages still happen. You just have
it
a different perspective around it.
Because if you think about it, Lisa, what is it that creates the heaviness? It's not necessarily. It can be, in a way, the circumstance. But in reality, it's not as much of the circumstance as our reaction to it, how we're responding to the things that happen to us, the thoughts and feelings that we have about stuff happening make it heavy or makes it very light. So if your thoughts and feelings weren't the director and producer of your daily show, how would you feel? You would be at a distance. Somewhat of a distance from the power and the seduction of your thoughts and feelings. And because of that, whatever came through on that mind stream that we all have, that daily mind stream, psychology says we've got about 80 to 100,000 thoughts a day. So if we could stand back from that and watch it more, like they teach in mindfulness, they wouldn't be impacting us in the same way.
Be the observer of your thoughts, as we've heard so many times.
Be more of a witness.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Okay, but the taxes and the rent still need to be paid. So you just observe the thought? No, I'm honestly asking.
No, I know. I know, it's a little funny hearing it from you. Go ahead.
Okay.
I love it. Go ahead.
What's funny about it?
Oh, it's funny listening to it back because if people haven't had the experience, they would go, well, how is this possible?
That's what you're here to teach us.
And that's what I'm attempting to do.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So ask me the question again.
All right. The rent and the mortgage still has to be paid.
They do.
So you become the observer of that thought.
Yes.
Even though you might not even know where that income is going to come from. And you move...
Well, since I'm a practicing therapist,
right.
I know it's going to come from my work.
Right, okay. Yeah. All right, good. So a friend of mine, this situation, her husband's job is slipping. She's worried about it. The phone's not ringing, and she is
yes.
really worried about it. So
yes.
in the fact that she's worrying about it is going to cause more of the same, as opposed to just be saying, well, the phone will ring. Maybe we can do some advertising and just be the observer of those thoughts, right?
Well, yes. What happens in her situation, and I've been there for most of my life, is that the worrying about it, what does the worrying do? It catalyzes all kinds of fears that we have about survival. And so the mind is a wonderful computer. It's like, you know, Google. If you put something in, it will bring up within nanoseconds all the reasons that it's true. And so if I'm having trouble paying my bill, the mind is going to tell me what's going to happen in the future, how we're going to lose the house. And I did go through this when I was sick. How we're going to lose the house, our kids can't go to private school, whatever it is, we can't pay for the car payment or the electricity. All of those things can happen because the mind is catalyzing fears. Those fears take us over. Those fears are heavy weights. They make us worry. They create all kinds of deep, dire feelings. And we all go through that. Nobody is spared from that. But if you learn to pull back from the thoughts and feelings, you realize that when the scary stuff comes, you don't have to believe it. You don't have to entertain it. It doesn't mean you stop acting toward a solution. It just means you're more free to do it more effectively.
True.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, you are more free. So you really can dissociate from the fear and the worry, become the observer of it, and then start to attract what it is that you want instead.
Correct, because you know the term self-fulfilling prophecy.
Oh, you get what you focus on, right?
Mm-hmm. Correct. So whatever you focus on becomes stronger in your awareness. And so if we're focusing on the fear, now it doesn't mean that we don't have to deal with the fear, because one of the things I work on with my clients is working with our fears so they're not as powerful, so we're not at their mercy. And we do that a lot. So we come into a better relationship with what's inside of us. That's a part of this skill set as well.
That makes a lot of sense. Makes a lot
I'm
of
glad.
Sense. Yeah. Oh, I'm only asking you this because when you come on the radio and you say, yes, you can be the observer of all of your fears and move through them, you need to be able to back it up. You've
well,
been through the experience.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you've been through the experience and you just articulating it really helps. I get what you're saying completely. And I've been right. there before. Actually, I go in, it's duality for me. Sometimes I go into the fear, but then I catch myself. I know better. And then I know what it is that I need to attract, what I focus on. So I just focus on what it is that I'm looking to attract. And I calm down and I start thinking about something else and then miracles open up. It's happened
right.
so many times that I start to
right.
see the pattern, and it really
right.
takes practice. It does. Yeah.
It takes a lot of practice. It's a lifetime kind of thing. And in order to attract miracles, miracles do happen occasionally for people, but in order to attract a more miraculous life, and again, if we're talking about miracles, we're talking about self-fulfillment. So the greatest miracle is knowing yourself.
Mm-hmm.
The greatest miracle is doing the work to open up the portals, to overcome the fears by working through them, to remember who you've always been. And that's there waiting for each of us patiently to come back home to.
Beautifully said. Is this what you call Earth School?
What is it?
Earth School. Earth School.
Yeah. I love Earth School. Yes. You wanna know about Earth School? This term came to me. I've been studying near-death experiences for about 20 years. And if for the listeners in the audience, the near-death experience is when someone, let's say, drowns and they're brought to the hospital and they appear to be dead, and the heart monitor and the brain monitor goes flatlined, and then all of a sudden they wake up. And they talk about what occurred during that 5, 10, 12 minutes that they seem to be dead. And so from all of those experiences, everybody talks about a couple of things. And this has always fascinated me. You know, Lisa, there have been about, I think, 100,000 or 125,000 pieces of research on this with case studies.
Wow. That's a lot now, more than there ever has been, yes.
Right. It started with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross back in the early 80s, mm-hmm. and then a guy by the name of Dr. James Moody continued her work.
Raymond Moody?
And James Moody?
James Moody? Oh, I thought it was Raymond Moody. Okay.
Oh, Raymond Moody. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for helping me with that. Dr. Raymond Moody.
Yes.
So the first thing people come back with is that we're here in order to learn to love. And one of the people that I had read recently said, the only thing you can take to heaven is the love you've given out on earth. And that really resonated with me. So we're here to love. That was the most important thing people came back with. The second was mm-hmm. that earth was a school for the souls. And that we come here to do the work of the souls, which is to forget who we've always been and to go through the arduous and long process of recovering who we are if we can, to know who we are as a heavenly eternal creature. And the third thing they came back with was they never feared death again.
Right. True.
And that was across the board.
It's
almost
yeah.
Everybody.
It's interesting though, because my fear of death, right, the lack of fear of death that I have from experiencing the near death experience, doesn't help my loved ones. That their experience of me, if I were to die, or my relatives dying. You know, even if I'm not afraid of it, how do I know my relatives dying would have the same experience I did? And
but they wouldn't, in terms of, I'm trying to understand what you're saying. So you're not afraid of death.
Right.
And so you would go to death with whatever degree of an open heart you would have. And
yes.
Your relatives would what?
Well, then my fear is, would my family have that same experience of me? No, they would suffer. So
they would suffer.
Yeah, I would not.
There's no question.
Welcome death at all, because it would hurt so many of the people that in my daughter and my family.
Yes,
and,
it would.
Yeah,
it's very, very one of the great and most painful things in life.
And yet, I look at like my father, who's very ill, and him dying. How do I know he would have the same experience that I had? Maybe because he's a scientist and he believes in science, that he wouldn't have that experience, because his belief system is firmly rooted in science.
Absolutely. I agree with what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, after he made his death, whenever that would be, I believe he would have the similar experience that they talk about in the NDEs, which is he would feel this great joy. He would feel a release of his personality. He would meet different relatives or friends who had gone before, and they would greet him on the other side. And he would be free to experience himself as an eternal soul. So I do believe that happens to everyone, but moving through the process is different for everyone getting
right
to that doorway.
We would, that more so comforts the living. I've always said death is hardest for the living.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
Yeah, and the people that live, survive you. And it's a it's really an individual belief system concept. And you cannot project that belief system onto anyone else.
I agree.
Yeah.
Because the way we live is also the way we die. If we live with an open heart, we die with an open heart to whatever degree.
Mm-hmm.
If we live with generosity and optimism, we probably face death that way. If we live with anger and animosity and bias, that journey to death's door is going to be difficult.
Yes, that would make sense. So that would make you want to live your life in a different way. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You would think.
Right.
Now, you created a pilot program for this meditation for prisoners. And
I did.
And I would love to know the story behind that and why you created it.
Well, you know, I was I lived in Europe for about 2.5 years. And what I was doing, this was when I was in my 20s. And what I was doing there was I was both on meditation courses and I was running hotels for the meditation courses in Spain and Italy and Switzerland. And when I was there, we had the great privilege, and in fact, Deepak Chopra was on those courses with me in the early 80s. And we had the great privilege of spending each evening with Maharishi Mahesh Yogi and various Nobel Prize winners in physics, biology, different kinds of sciences. I became so inspired. I mean, it's really the inspiration of long meditations in Europe and listening to these esteemed individuals. I got so inspired that I thought, why not do a prison, take this into prison with this extreme kind of suffering. And all these people have felt rejected from life. They've rejected life itself. They've caused tremendous pain, and they're in tremendous pain. Let me see what we can do if we bring it to prison. So at that point, I went to Rahway State Prison, and I brought all my TM literature.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to, you know, some of the directors there, and they, honestly, to my amazement, they said they'd like to try it. And I'll tell you a funny story. So I had my first group of prisoners. I had done a introductory lecture to meditation, came back again, did a second lecture, and then to the prison population, whoever wanted to start came to my class. And there were about 30 inmates there, and I was starting to teach the meditation, and I asked them to close their eyes because they were going to start using the mantra, and there's a mantra in TM. And I closed my eyes, and I opened my eyes after about, probably a minute to see if everybody was doing it. And everybody had their eyes open. And I thought, what's going on here?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, listen, in order for this meditation to work, you have to close your eyes.
Mm.
And one guy raised his hand, and he said, I'm not closing my eyes in this room.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And so I had to negotiate with them what it would take for them to close their eyes and learn to meditate. And so we came to an agreement that if there were certain, I don't know what they're called, like wardens, there were certain wardens in the room, placed around the room, they would trust that closing their eyes wouldn't lead to their death. That's how it all started.
Huh. Wow. Wow.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah, no, that's great. So did they get something out of the meditation? And how long did you do that for?
I did it for a while. I mean, we actually did a research study on it. So it went on for about 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there once a month for about 6 months. And
what was the research study?
The research study was to see the impact and effects of meditation on social behavior, on affect, on daily emotions and things like that. And it was very successful. And actually out of that, not that I did it after that, but out of that came a tremendous amount of work in the prisons with meditation and yoga and mindfulness.
Mm, that's fantastic, and that it actually made an impact in a...
It made a huge impact. I'm sure. People were coming up to me and just thanking me profusely because they had the first taste of peace in their life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And for day-to-day, moment-to-moment life, that meditation really can help. Yeah.
So much. So much for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Get through moment-to-moment. Now, in terms of your practice now, what is the main thing that people are concerned about these days that you hear about from other people? What is it that people come to
you? In my
psychotherapy practice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, aside from everybody's issues, which, you know, go on forever while we're here on Earth, I would say that anxiety, people are very anxious. They're very anxious about the state of the world, about our politics. They're very anxious about Trump. They're very anxious about the state of the world and the fact that the world seems to be pulling apart at the seams. So that's big in my practice.
Mm, really? The concern about the instability of our political environment?
Very much so. Mm. And obviously some people talk about the environment mixed into that as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And the fact that we're not listening to, not taking seriously the reports that are coming from the United Nations, which we're not, and even the federal government. So aside from people's day-to-day stuff, as kind of more global reach, they're talking about that.
It's becoming so much in people's awareness more and more now, which is, I think, in a way that it's great to be aware of these issues so that we can eventually really do something about them rather than being
Absolutely.
Asleep about them. I don't know what can be done yet, but it should. I know that there's a lot of brilliant minds working on it. And
there are.
Yeah.
They really are.
That is amazing to me that that's pretty much at the vein of your psychotherapy practice, and people listening will completely identify with that and understand.
Absolutely. We're all at the behest of the world. We're part of this group called humanity.
Yeah, yeah, and life school.
And what impacts anybody anywhere impacts us.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Whether it's a drought or refugees leaving Syria, it's like an underground river, a network that we're all a part of. And whether you read the paper or not, what's happening to other people in other places is impacting you in a direct way, in an unconscious way, and it's affecting your state of mind, and it's impacting the amount of happiness, anxiety, depression, and joy you have.
So if you thought about all of it and took all of that on, you wouldn't be able to move. How do you,
right?
How do you, yeah.
Right?
How do you give people the advice to be able to do something about that in meditation?
Well, there are two parts of this. First of all, as we talked about before, your thoughts and feelings are what causes the heaviness in your life. So stepping back from those, becoming the witness, is going to make you more effective in being proactive. I often talk to many of my clients about being of service, to move out of a self-obsessed position to a service position, and to find things in the neighborhood or even on a national level
mm-hmm.
where they feel they're participating in helping make the world a better place.
It does really, really make an impact, especially if you have any personal issues going on, to be a part of a bigger solution. It's very amazing how that it does settle. As you said, it takes your focus on something that you want rather than obsessing on things that aren't working.
Right. It's just so helpful for people. Usually, my clients coming in are not expecting me to talk about being of service in their community, but that's something we usually get to, because I think all of us in service, as you just said, allow us to feel like we're making a difference, have meaning and purpose in our lives.
It's true. And if I think more people tried that, then we would have a more compassionate world.
We would.
Yeah. And it's
because you learn about other people's lives and mm-hmm. you begin to feel for them.
My daughter and I are involved in a really wonderful mother-daughter charity league, and it's so cool to do something with your child that is helping and serving humanity and to see the value in something like that. It serves as two things. You know, you get to spend great time together.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, and then you get to just stuff like that. To add something like that is simple to do in your life, and it can be once a month, it can be, you know, however often you can do that, it changes the quality of your life and your experience
so
of life.
So rewarding.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So rewarding.
Right, but not from not only if you're overprivileged or if you're, you know, only have the spare time. It's something to actively pursue in your life, even if it's inconvenient,
right.
You know?
Good. I like that.
Yeah.
Good medicine, my dear.
Well, thank you very much. This has been a great conversation. I hope you enjoyed it.
I loved it. Can I tell people how to get in touch with me?
Absolutely. Yes.
Okay, there are two things. One is I did a 17-part video series when I came out of my illness called Secrets of the Universe, Walking the Conscious Path. And that's on YouTube, free for anybody who wants to use it, to listen to it. And then I've got a website, stevehassenberg.com, where they can find out about the stuff I do. And I totally enjoyed hanging out with you, Lisa. It was wonderful.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And I'm really grateful that you are healed. And thank you for sharing all this information with us. A lot got covered here today. And
you're so welcome.
Yeah, thank you again. Secrets of the Universe, you can look up on YouTube by Steve Hassenberg or go to his website, stevehassenberg.com. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lisa.
All right. Take care. And I want to thank our wonderful listeners for engaging in this conversation. Your energy makes these conversations happen. And thank you, Gina Salvati, executive producer of The Aware Show, and Joyce Walker, producer of The Aware Show. And I am Lisa Garr. Until next time, I invite you to stay aware.